Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Monday, November 28th, 2016, and this is show number 603. Well, I really appreciate you guys waiting an extra day for the show so that Steve and I could go see the musical Mamma Mia yesterday. Now, there's actually a connection to the podcast why we did this. A gentleman named Shai Yamini has been on the podcast several times. He's a singer, a dancer, a photographer, and a videographer. We can't actually afford to have him on the show that often because the plugins he recommends are so expensive. Anyway, we went to see Mamma Mia because he was playing the lead male character, Sam, in Mamma Mia. Nocilla Castaways and friends, Dorothy, also known as Mac Lurker in the chat room, and Pat Dengler, also known as Your Mac Doctor, and Brett, also known as B. Kennedy in the chat room, said we should do a Nocilla Castaways meetup. And then Steve got involved, and suddenly I found out I'm going to something with music in it. Then I got a crazy idea. Barry Falk, the mastermind of the Midwest Mac Barbecue and cohort of Mike Potter's in creating Mac Stock, has another hobby, and that's surprising people by simply showing up to things in cities where he doesn't live. I texted Barry, who lives in Chicago, and I asked him if he wanted to surprise everyone, even Steve, and show up at Mamma Mia. And 10 minutes later, he had booked his tickets to fly out here. Watching Steve answer the door the day of the event and having Barry just standing there at the door was spectacular. The only downside is that Steve says he can't trust me anymore. Anyway, it was fantastic to see Shai performing this role in front of 3,000 people. I have so many favorite parts about this, but one of the real highlights was meeting his lovely and hilarious wife, Jessica. Well, this might be a good excuse for a bunch of Nocilla Castaways meetups all over the country. It turns out the show is on tour around the U.S. I know Denise is already going when they get to Austin, so maybe this could be, I don't know, a thing. If you're listening to the show, I'm sure Shai will consider you a friend. The tour will be going in Washington, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia. I'm looking at you, Kevin. Maryland, Iowa. Come on, Kirshen. Start a party. Kansas, Oklahoma for George, Utah for Dean, Minnesota. Pretty much every state in the continental United States. I put a link in the show notes to the Mamma Mia touring schedule. So start organizing some Nocilla Castaway meetups, would you? All right. Enough goofing around. We probably should do some tech stuff, right? I got to tell you, it's a little lonely right now because other than Grace Hopper, my cat purring here in my lap, I'm all alone without the Nocilla Castaways in the live chat room. So I'm going to try to bear up, but I got to tell you, it's kind of lonely without those people. In Chit Chat Across the Pond this week, Bart gave me another 2 weeks off to get my homework done on programming by stealth. And instead this week, he brings us a case study of how to create a JavaScript API on GitHub. He uses a real life example of a small open source library that he released over the weekend called bartificer.linktoolkit.js. This library includes many of the bits and pieces we've been working on in programming by stealth, like how to add a rel of no opener on all the links with targets of underscore blank, you know, the ones that open in new tabs, and adding a little icon in the URL to politely tell the reader that you'll be navigating away from the page you're on. It's a great lesson in the structure of how GitHub works, and even more importantly, how it automatically creates beautiful documentation for markdown comments in the code. 6 years ago, I splurged and bought myself a 24-inch Apple Cinema display. I love that display. It was huge in that day, and it worked perfectly with my 2011 MacBook Pro. In 2013, I upgraded to the fancy new Retina MacBook Pro, but something weird started happening. Fairly frequently, the monitor would simply turn off and back on again. It wasn't quite a blink, but it was sort of a slow off and back on. I took the new Mac and the display into Apple, which is kind of a lot to carry, and they checked it out. They said nothing was wrong with either device, but the genius found documentation that there was a firmware issue between the two devices. He suggested I give it a little while, and I would be pushed the firmware update. You know, I know I live on the bleeding edge, and this is the penalty I pay, so I was actually cool with it at first. A month later, I contacted them, and they said, yeah, there's a firmware update coming. Wait for it. Another month went by. Another month went by. Finally, after, I don't know, 3 or 4 months of having a seizure-inducing blinking happening, I pushed up to the highest tier support I could find, and I suggested that there was a better solution to just keep waiting for it. I thought, you know, with $4,000 worth of equipment on my desk from them, I should not have to put up with this. They finally agreed, and they shipped me out a replacement monitor. Tragically, the 24-inch was no longer available, so I was forced to accept the 27-inch version. Anyway, the 27-inch they shipped me was the last of the DisplayPort Apple displays, even though the new Thunderbolt displays had been announced. Now, I couldn't really complain as I was getting a brand new $1,000 monitor, and I was even able to put it under AppleCare. So fast forward to last week when I upgraded to the new Touch Bar MacBook Pro. I bought the USB-C to Thunderbolt adapter, which is the same form factor as the mini DisplayPort connector on my 27-inch display. So I plugged in the monitor, only to discover that the new MacBook Pros cannot drive a DisplayPort monitor. Now, I've put a link to the Apple support article, HT207266, if you want to read all about it. Now, I had gotten an early warning from Victor Cahiao about this. He cited Katie Floyd's post about it, actually. So I wasn't shocked, but I was sad that it was actually true. I was hoping she was wrong, hoping against hope. But, you know, Katie's not often wrong. The story isn't all gloom and doom, though. A couple of years ago, I got rid of the nasty Dell display I'd originally given Steve, back when I bought myself the Apple Cinema display, and I replaced his Dell with a 27-inch Apple Thunderbolt display. According to the Apple support article, his monitor would work with my new Mac. We brought my monitor into his office and connected it to his 27-inch iMac, and he said he couldn't tell the difference, so he graciously agreed to swap with me. Now, it's important to note that he isn't running any Thunderbolt devices hooked to it, so really, the only change was that he had two useless cables hanging off of it instead of one. You see, both monitors come with a Chimera. It's a cable that has more than one thing on it. His, the DisplayPort version comes with power for the Mac to charge it, DisplayPort, and USB. But the Thunderbolt version only needs power and Thunderbolt, since USB can travel over Thunderbolt. We swapped the displays and instantly I was back in business. So I got a pretty awesome husband or what? Anyway, as I've mentioned earlier, when I ordered my new Mac, I bought a few dongles. But let's be clear here. I've had to buy dongles on every laptop I bought in the last 6 years. People are crazy about this whole dongle thing, but I already had VGA, DVI, HDMI, and all matter of connectors on the other end. With USB-C, I added two more USB-A dongles, one for Ethernet and one for Thunderbolt. But I had all those dongles before. I even had an Ethernet dongle before for my old machine. So I plugged in the power adapter, the monitor to the Thunderbolt, my USB 3 hub, and my mic interface to the fourth USB-C port via USB-A. After unplugging and plugging them back in a few times, like every time I wanted to lift this up, I'd unplug all four of these things. I realized it's somehow more tedious to unplug and plug back in four USB-C cables every time I wanted to use my new Mac than whatever I was unplugging with my old Mac. I told Steve, I'm going to have to buy a dock for this thing because it was driving me nuts. Well, Steve left the room and came back carrying the Belkin Thunderbolt Express dock that I bought him a few years ago, and he asked me if it would help. We didn't ever end up using it. It was for a very specialized case that we thought we were going to need it. Sure enough, it absolutely does meet all of my needs. Now, the Belkin Thunderbolt Express dock is actually an older dock, so if you're interested, you'd probably want a newer model, but I was able to plug my USB-C to Thunderbolt adapter into the Mac and in turn connect Thunderbolt to the dock. With the Belkin Thunderbolt Express dock, I now have Gigabit Ethernet FireWire 800, don't need that, but I have it, three USB 3.0 ports, two Thunderbolt 2 ports, plus one audio in and one audio out port. I don't actually have any Thunderbolt devices other than one drive I bought a long time ago, or Steve actually bought me, but it turned out it was a 5400 RPM drive anyway, so Thunderbolt 2 will be fast enough for that. The audio in-out port, or the audio output, I should say, on the dock came as a very welcome surprise that I was not expecting. Even though the 2016 new MacBook Pro does have a headphone jack, that's just one more thing I have to plug in every time I do a podcast recording. Now I can keep my headphones plugged into the dock, and anytime I need to monitor my own voice or hear someone on Skype, they're ready to go. Now, I did have to figure out what macOS would call the headphones when they're not plugged into the headphone jack, but rather through the Thunderbolt dock. macOS decided to name the headphone jack on the dock USB PNP sound device. PNP stands for plug and play. Once I discovered that, I was back in business. I'll have to remember to switch to it when I want to monitor audio, since my headphones will always be active, but that's easier than plugging and unplugging all the time. Plus, there's the added bonus of how I'll be confused during the live show because something's changed. Now, I've got the Thunderbolt dock tucked away, sort of behind my monitor, with all the cables hanging down behind my back, and just two cables coming into my Mac, Thunderbolt from the dock and power. I think I'll ask for a second power supply for my new Mac so I can have the cable thrown backwards with all the others and have one for traveling around. Then things will be super clean. So one more thing. Last week, I mentioned one thing I didn't like about the default touch bar controls was that I had to tap twice to change volume or screen brightness. I know I'm a whiner, right? Big third world problem. Wait, first world problem, I should say. Anyway, Giles Croft shot me a tweet where he pointed to a great video by Jason Snell of Six Colors, where he demonstrates all kinds of cool stuff on the touch bar. One of the very first things Jason shows is that when you tap on the volume or brightness, you can immediately slide your finger left, right, and it brings up the slider and starts adjusting for you as you touch it. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Giles. Now I want to talk to you about how not to do Migration Assistant. When I got the 2016 Touch Bar 15-inch MacBook Pro, it was only about a month after I'd done that involuntary nuke and pave on my 2013 MacBook Pro. For those unfamiliar with the term nuke and pave, that's when you erase everything, including the operating system, and then install everything from scratch. You can drag your documents over from a backup or another Mac, but you don't bring over the network settings, or license files, or any customizations you've made. I have lauded the benefits of a nuke and pave over the years on the podcast, and I'm still a huge believer in doing it around once a year. I'm not saying I get around to it once a year, but I think it's worth it if you can. It's painful and it's time consuming. Think days before everything is back to just so. But the advantages of speed and freed up disk space are enormous. Your Mac will feel like it did when it was new. Anyway, since I just had the joy of doing all this about a month ago, I was completely uninterested in doing all of that again on the new Mac. 2 weeks ago, I told you the story of how I tried to use Migration Assistant for the first time to accomplish the task. I explained that I hooked the 2013 and 2016 Macs up to a gigabit switch hooked to my router, and yet the migration took forever, or was taking forever, I should say. And forever in my book is defined as 125 gigabytes of data transferring in 4.5 hours. That is way too slow. So I want to dig a bit further in exactly what I originally did, give you a problem to be solved, and then walk you through what actually worked in the end to give me a successful migration from the 2013 to 2016 MacBook Pro. I'm hopeful this will help some of you in the future. So, back to our 125 gig transferred in 4.5 hours. How can I really say that's forever unless we define how long it should have taken? We're going to have to do some math, starting with converting bytes to bits. There are 8 bits in a byte, so we have to multiply the 125 gigabytes by 8 to get the number of gigabits that were transferred. So 125 gigabytes times 8 is 1,000 gigabits to transfer. If I'm transferring over gigabit Ethernet, that means I should be transferring at 1 gigabit per second, so I should be able to move 1,000 gigabits in 1,000 seconds. Dividing by 60, we get that 125 gigabytes should have transferred in 17 minutes. Not 4.5 hours. Now, I know your mileage may vary on this kind of thing, and you know, all kinds of stuff can wreck the speed, but with pretty recent SSDs on both machines, which I personally have measured at 850 megabytes per second read and write on the slower machine, those numbers just didn't make any sense. As my data was simply crawling from one machine to the next, Steve and I studied things to make sure I wasn't, you know, misunderstanding what I'd actually set up. We looked at the Ethernet cables I'd chosen and verified that they said Cat 6 on them. Cat 5 is only 100 base T, or 100 megabits per second. Get those bits and bytes correct. So if I'd chosen Cat 5, that might have explained it, but they were Cat 6 cables. Steve then studied the switch itself, which said it was a gigabit switch. He looked on the back for the little blinky lights. My particular switch is from Netgear, and it has a light on either side of each port. One says 10, the other says 100. That sounded concerning, but a graphic on the switch said that if both are blinking, you're getting 1,000 megabits per second. Both were blinking on all three involved ports. So why was my transfer going at about a 16th of the speed it should have been going? The only thing I could figure was maybe it was ignoring the cables and it was using Wi-Fi. I went back to the iPerf test that Steve and I conducted on the Netgear Nighthawk X8, and the Wi-Fi speeds were 524 megabits per second when we tested right next to the Netgear. 524 megabits per second divided by 8 is 65 megabytes per second. But the screen showed that I was only getting 6. So while Wi-Fi should have been 10 times as fast, I decided to try and kill it off anyway, because this was just, I don't know, I couldn't figure out what else to do. So I quit the process of migration assistant, and on both machines, I turned off Wi-Fi and I started over. But still, it was transferring at 6 megabytes a second. I looked at the migration assistant connection windows, and for some unknown reason, it showed me I was still using Wi-Fi. I was baffled, but by this time, I had fooled around with this long enough, and I really wanted to finish doing it and play with my new machine, so I abandoned that whole path, and I selected only apps for Migration Assistant, which tootled over quite quickly, actually. They're not that big. Then I simply dragged my data over by hand, which only took about 20 minutes, like it should have. I have no clue why Migration Assistant failed me, but I was glad to be rid of it. So that at least proved that I was right about that I was going gigabit, and that was going through the switch and through those cables, right? I still don't know why Migration Assistant was so lame. So at this point, you're thinking, hey, Al, you know, this is nice, and, you know, we like to get more geeky detail, but why are you repeating the substance of the story from 2 weeks ago? It's because I haven't yet told you the problem to be solved. While my new Mac was basically working, after re-authenticating every single app from the Mac App Store and entering license codes for every single app outside of the Mac App Store, there was one big problem. I was unable to start up iCloud Photo Library. Now, in the past, I've complained bitterly about how iCloud Photo Library tries to re-upload all of my photos, all 65,000 of them, every time I touch iCloud. I mean, if I say the word iCloud too loud, and I probably just triggered it again. It just says, oh, I got to upload all 65,000 photos, which it doesn't really do, but it apparently compares them all. So it takes days to not do it. But that's not the problem I was having. This problem's even worse. I would click the little checkbox to turn on iCloud Photo Library, and about 5 to 10 minutes later, it would just turn itself off. After several days of fighting with this, I called AppleCare. My little friend Mary and I worked through several ideas, none of which worked. She asked me to run a diagnostic tool that would generate some log files that I could then ship back to Apple, and she would in turn send the files to engineering. I have learned through personal past experience that send to engineering means wait several weeks or more and get back the answer, we can't figure it out. If you get any answer at all, that's the best answer you get. Sometimes they never answer me at all. I don't know, maybe my problems are just harder than other people's, but so far they're batting 0 for 3 in that market. I spent some time noodling the log files that were generated myself, though, and I discovered something very odd. System Integrity Protection, also known as SIP, was turned off. To remind you of what System Integrity Protection is, according to Apple, it is a security technology in OS X, El Capitan, and later that's designed to help prevent potentially malicious software from modifying protected files and folders on your Mac. System Integrity Protection restricts the root user account and limits the actions that the root user can perform on protected parts of the Mac operating system. So this is a feature you definitely want on by default. I tweeted out asking if anyone else had noticed that it was off on their new MacBook Pros and discovered this is actually a widespread issue. M. Laundry, Mike Werthel, Don McAllister, and David Southard all pointed me to articles like the one at iMore that reported on the issue. The good news is that it's pretty easy to turn on. The bad news is that it's super geeky. You have to boot into recovery mode using Command R, launch the terminal, and type in CSR util enable, then reboot. Like I said, that's easy enough for us since we've tamed the terminal and all, but can you imagine trying to get your uncle to do that? All right, let's keep going with the story because that was a complete side lobe that has nothing to do with my iCloud Photo Library problem, but I was really proud of my little self for finding that log in the log files. I didn't read about it. I actually found it myself. I should mention that I did try Googling turn on iCloud Photo Library and other combinations like iCloud Photo Library keeps turning itself off, but every hit would either be how to turn it off or on. I found a couple of people in the Apple discussion forums with the exact problem I had, and I tried the solution suggested there, including things like fixing permissions, but nothing fixed the problem for me. While I was waiting what would surely be an interminable length of time for the engineers at Apple to get back to me, if they ever did, I posted my iCloud Photo Library turning itself off problem in our Google Plus group, our Facebook group, and in the Mac Geek Gab Facebook group. Gary Hayes and Greg in LA from the Mac Geek Gab both jumped in with ideas. They had me turn off iCloud, which Pat Dengler had also suggested, and then turn it back on. I was afraid to do it because I was afraid that silly load all my files up to the internet thing would happen. But at that point, I didn't have much to lose. That didn't work, of course, but I did do it. We also tried disabling Keychain because we found some errors about Keychain in those logs that I sent to Apple. And we turned off Keychain, disabled it, turned it back on. We tried dragging my Keychain files out of the library and back. We deleted plist. Nothing fixed it. By then, I was whining to Stephen Getz on Telegram, as I am wont to do when things go awry. And he reminded me that I had aborted the migration assistant. And maybe that's why I was having a problem. I realized that after I aborted it, I didn't wipe the system clean in any way. I just kept going forward. I didn't recreate the account or anything. We started noodling whether maybe I've got a completely borked system at that point. It was time for drastic measures. It's time for yet another nuke and pave. Okay, not exactly, but a nuke for sure. Before I started down the path that finally worked, I first tried to use my super duper backup from my old Mac to the new. I verified that I could boot from it on the old Mac, and then I tried to boot from it on the new Mac. Instead of booting up, I got a black screen with a white circle on it. I searched through the super duper site and found no clues on how to fix this, and I wrote to the very responsive developer Dave Nanian over at shirt-pocket.com. I also tweeted out the question. Stephen Hackett of Relay.fm answered, as did Dave Nanian, that new Macs come with a slightly different build of the operating system, which means that usually you can't boot from the backup drive when you've got a brand new machine. Well, that was kind of an aggravating answer, but at least I understood why it was failing. Dave went on to explain that I could use Migration Assistant with my backup and choose another Mac, and it would be able to see the drive as though it were another Mac, even though I couldn't boot from it. So that's good information to keep in the old back pocket. As I thought about that, though, I realized that while my backup drive is a snazzy new USB 3 drive, it's only 7,200 RPM, big spinning hard drive, so I'd really suffer on transfer speeds anyway, read and write anyway. I really wanted to take advantage of the SSDs in the two Macs. So here's the path I chose that finally actually worked and worked really well. I booted the new Mac into safe mode by holding down the shift key. This boots you into a partition so that you can do anything you want to the boot drive. I opened Disk Utility from within safe mode, and I erased my entire drive. Then I chose Reinstall Mac OS and put a fresh and untainted in any way version of Sierra on it. Now, here's the hot tip. When I booted the new Mac up, I did not tell it my Wi-Fi password. I figured if it didn't know the password, it couldn't possibly default back to it. Then I put a gigabit cable between the two machines, skipping the switch and the router just in case they were a bottleneck, even though dragging with it connected that way didn't do anything. And I launched Migration Assistant on both of the Macs and I hit go. The transfer immediately jumped up to 91 megabytes a second. Remember it was 6 before? Now we're talking. 91 megabytes is 728 megabits per second, or just 3/4 of full gigabit. At this point, I'll take that. The entire transfer, which turned out to be 725 gigabytes, took 2.5 hours. Remember before I had 125 gig in 4.5 hours. I got 725 in 2.5 hours. Now, I also want to mention that while I was rallying the courage to nuke my Mac yet again, I walked through my plan with Stephen Getz. He suggested I use Thunderbolt to connect the two computers instead of Ethernet. We argued about specs. He won like he usually does. But it's harder than it should be to talk about the speed of Thunderbolt because the sites that I looked at that try to explain it, they talk about lanes and things. But I think Thunderbolt 3 on the new Mac is 40 gigabits per second. I think Thunderbolt 2 or maybe Thunderbolt 1 is 10 gigabits per second. I don't know. But in any case, Thunderbolt 3 would be 40. Even 10 gigabits per second would be really good. That would have been a lot faster than my 1 gigabit per second Ethernet, right? Well, even though I believed him, I told him I wasn't going to risk it because the Migration Assistant instructions from Apple very clearly said use Ethernet. When I sent him the screenshot showing the data flying over at 91 megabytes per second, he pointed out that right below it, the speed, it said, you know, you could go faster if you plug in a Thunderbolt cable, don't you? I hate it when he's right, which is pretty much always, like I said. Anyway, now that I look back at the instructions from Apple, they do mention Thunderbolt. I don't know where I thought it said only Ethernet. Oh, well, what are you going to do? Like I said, I hate it when Steven's right, which is close to all the time, but I'm glad he was right that it was time to nuke and pave yet again, and that he reminded me that I had aborted that session. The best part of the story is that not only does iCloud Photo Library work perfectly now, but for the first time in any migration of data I have ever done, It did not start uploading all of my photos yet again. I think iCloud Photo Library has been tricked into thinking this is the same machine, because it sort of is, right? Just the hardware's different. Lots of other stuff is working better now too, like my crash plan backup doesn't have to be adopted because it thinks this is the old machine. My super duper backup is working already, and overall, it's just a whole lot more stable than it was. And I didn't have to install all those app codes in again like I did before. It just works. So my advice on doing Migration Assistant is to immediately do Migration Assistant. Don't play with the Mac at all. Don't set up other accounts that would find out about your Wi-Fi password. Just start it. Use the fastest protocol you can find, cross your fingers and toes, and I'm sure it'll work just fine. It's that holiday season again, and if I know you, you're shopping online like a good little geek without leaving your house, so you don't have to talk to real people, right? I bet at least some of that time you're shopping on Amazon. It would delight me if you went to podfeet.com when you think of Amazon and then click on the big Amazon button there. That button is not a tracker. Doesn't have embedded JavaScript. It's plain old image with a link. That's all it is. If you do that and you click it and then do your shopping, a small percentage of what you spend goes to help support the podcast. I don't care if you're buying diapers or that SSD your sister really wants. Every little bit helps. If you'd rather support the show through Patreon with a monthly pledge, head on over to podfeet.com/Patreon. Your support is much appreciated. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchatz. And I don't know how I succeeded doing this to you, Bart, but I somehow led you to believe you got a week off somewhere and you've been on like three times in a row, four times. And it's a wonderful thing for me.
I think I genuinely have next weekend off.
I think you do. But I personally
have other things I need to get done.
Barry Falk surprised Steve last night and showed up at the house. And we were chatting this morning and he said, you know, there's something about Bart's voice that I can just listen to him talk about absolutely anything. Like, I don't really know anything about the terminal, but I listen to every one of the Taming the Terminal episodes. Aww. And he even said nice things about me. He said that I tend to interrupt you right when he gets stuck and go, wait, what are you talking about? And he likes that. And but he said he agreed that there has never been a Security Bits that went on too long. Even he'll look at it and go, whoa, it's an hour? And then he's never bored. So our all concerted opinion is Security Bits should be every week. But
time. If I had a 28-hour day, I would happily do that. It's not for want of wanting to. It's just that real life has this awful habit of demanding I do other things as well. It's very annoying.
Right. Well, if you ever feel the urge to throw in an extra Security Bits, you're just well welcome.
Noted. Although we do sometimes do a Security Medium, right? When the universe throws us a wobbler.
There you go. All right, let's dig in.
Okay, quite a bit actually today, but I guess it's a good thing. So no security updates of note, but plenty of security news of note. So the first thing is that I think probably the most pressing story is that the Locky ransomware has found a new way of spreading itself. The details are still a bit vague, and I just checked the Irish Technical link for an update, and there is nothing more to add. But somehow, the Locky evil people are abusing some sort of as yet unspecified bug in Facebook and LinkedIn to force download a sort of a booby-trapped image file, which if the user double-clicks on, ends up infecting them with Locky. So the thing would be you would wander onto Facebook, do your thing, find a file sitting in your downloads folder that you're like, oh, I wonder what that is, double-click it, and then you're screwed.
Yeah, so I was looking at this, and they reference Windows several times. They don't say whether it's cross-platform or not.
Oh, I don't think Locky itself is cross-platform. I think Locky is a Windows malware.
Okay. On the Mac, you see this thing fly through the air. Do you know whether on Windows you see something visual that tells you that something's getting downloaded?
It's certainly not that dramatic animation that the Mac has, but I would imagine that your downloads icon would flash or something, or you'd get the little bar at the bottom of Internet Explorer that says, ooh, you've downloaded a file.
Yeah, so if something downloads that you didn't see coming, don't open it.
Absolutely. Delete.
Yeah, by the way, in the show notes it said Twitter, but it is LinkedIn, correct?
It is, yeah.
I'm just looking LinkedIn. Here. Good, I got
Facebook
it fixed.
Facebook and LinkedIn, so okay, great. Thank you. So that's probably the most pressing story. And as it would be nice to have more detail, but so far everyone's keeping shtum, which I guess means that the problem is not fixed yet. And I'm sure we'll find out more when they do fix it.
Yeah, what I saw was that the person who found this, who figured out how this exploit is being done has talked to Facebook and LinkedIn, and they're not going to talk about how it was done until they fix it.
Which is irresponsible disclosure. We're all in favor of that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so, right. Android users, strap in. You're not going to enjoy this show. Particularly if you own a phone from an American company called Blue without an E. Well, they make $60 phones, and I guess the way you save money is because you're completely hosed.
Okay.
So let me see. So the first thing is that security research has discovered data stealing malware on cheap Android phones from manufacturers, including but not limited to Blue.
Wait. Built into the phones?
Yes, shipped. Part of the firmware that ships
these. Jeez.
So the malware sends lots of personal data back to servers in China every 72 hours. The authors insist that it's for ad selling at you, not for selling you to the Chinese government. Oh, and by the way, we'd only meant to do this to our Chinese customers. We accidentally did it to all our customers. And I'm like, oh, so that makes it all okay.
Yeah, doing it to people in China, I mean, who cares about those people? What?
Yeah, exactly. So this is gathering everything you do in your phone, including your text messages and all sorts of stuff. It's pretty vile. And so they have pushed an over-the-air update to remove it from non-Chinese phones.
Non-Chinese phones.
Well, that's what I can make from the statement anyway. So, and they were big to point out to the New York Times when the company were asked for comment. No. This isn't state actors. This is a private company that made a mistake. This is not cyber war. This is a private company that made a mistake. Perhaps the lady doth protest too much. I don't know. So either way, the whole thing leaves a bad taste in my mouth. Now, of course, these phones sell for $60. You cannot make a smartphone for $60. So this should always set off alarm bells. If something is so cheap, you're not the customer. Like, you've got to be the product being sold. And how egregious that is, I guess, is to be found out. But you cannot get a smartphone for $60 and not be in some way getting a really raw deal. And, well, here we go. And there'll be another news story for Blue owners in a moment. But that's later in the show notes. The US DHS have released Strategic Principles for Securing the Internet of Things. This might make an interesting read for people, but I guess the people who it needs to make the most interesting read for is people who make these things, because they basically lay out a bunch of design principles that you should use when developing IoT things. Things like build security in from the start, not as a bolt-on at the end. Sensible stuff like that. And they do also, they write it from two perspectives. They write it from the point of view of users buying stuff, what they should care about, and they write it from the point of view of people making stuff, what they should care about. On the one hand, it's just talk, but on the other hand, well, I'm glad someone's taken the time to write this stuff down and present it in a way that could be useful to people making and buying these things.
Is there anything, is it a good document? I mean, did you have a chance to scan it?
I scanned it only. I didn't have time to read it. It seemed sane and sensible to me. And the commentary I've heard in it from others is basically, common sense.
Okay. So it looks like it's not specifics like, use this kind of encryption.
Right. And you don't actually want specifics because
those get old.
Those get old quickly in this industry. What you want is principles. So yeah, I think this is an appropriate, and maybe this could be step one towards getting some sort of certification. First off, define what the principles are, and then maybe define some sort of program for testing and certifying these things. But anyway, I think it can't do any harm, and it may just do some good. So yeah. Well done,
Mr. Department of Health. When I was on the board of the Santa Monica City College Computer Science Program, I talk to them about it was a really fun gig. Basically, you go pontificate once a year and then you walk away and don't have to do any work, so it's awesome and it sounds cool. But I talked to them about the idea of that there's a few basic things that you shouldn't teach as separate classes. They should be in every class, and accessibility and security should be in all of them. So you don't teach someone how, after they write a program, to go back and make it secure. You don't teach them after Correct. The fact, here's how you now make it accessible. As you're building this tool or this app or whatever, this is what you need to do to make it already be accessible and secure. And it sounds like that's kind of what they're saying in this about the security side.
It is what they're saying in this, that, yeah, you build security in from the start. And that's just a really good principle, period. Just in total, actually, you know, nothing to do with IoT, just everything you do with IoT. You always think about it.
Yeah. I have a feeling I want to just start sending this to vendors whenever they send me an Internet of Things thing going, are you following this? Get back to me.
Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. Okay, so a few weeks ago, we talked about a newly discovered then hypothetical problem. And the problem was that OS X and Windows both, even when your screen is locked and your device should technically not be doing things, if you plug a USB device in that tells the computer that it is a network device, the computer will go ahead and install and initialize it.
Oh, right, right, right. I remember this.
And we said that really they shouldn't do that. That's a bad idea. Well, now it's gone from hypothetical to actual. Software has been released called Poison Tap, open source. It's been released for free. And what it does is it takes the $5 Raspberry Pi Zero and turns it into a working exploit to weaponize this attack. So you basically have a small device that costs you $5. You shove this free software on it. You walk up to someone's computer, shove it in, and hack it.
So what does it plug into?
USB.
So they can't hack the new MacBook Pro.
Yes, they can.
Well, only if they have an adapter.
Yeah, but they're teeny tiny and very cheap.
No, I know, but like you'd have to be thinking that, right? It was a joke.
Right, you have a small amount of security by obscurity briefly until USB 3 becomes as ubiquitous as USB-A, which I think is just a matter of time.
Yeah. Well, so, that's nice. Is it being exploited in the wild, or we just know that it's super
possible? It's now available, so people can now do it. So basically, the bottom line is physical access to your computer is something you just don't want to give, so don't leave it unattended. Keep it with you.
How do you do that if you're in a work environment, you know, where you walk away, you go to a
meeting? One would assume that in a work environment, you're right, but in a work environment, you don't leave your computer unattended in an unsecured area, do you?
Sure, why not? If you got a cubicle, you go to a meeting?
Right, but the people in you, one would assume there's a basic security infrastructure that randomers can't walk into your office.
I don't know. There's somebody servicing the Xerox machine, right? I mean, it depends on who you trust.
But the attack surface is going to be pretty small in a corporate environment because people generally don't get by reception without having some sort of relationship with the place. I mean, I'm not saying that's perfect protection, but it's...
Yeah.
I wouldn't call that leaving your machine abandoned.
There was a classic line around my company where people would always blame the custodial workers or the construction workers whenever something bad would happen. And they'd always say, oh, you know, those people. And sure enough, we had a whole bunch of computers stolen by the construction workers that were let in because they were doing construction. So I don't know.
I guess the smaller your organization, the less of an issue that is. But there's some things that are unavoidable, right?
Yeah.
You got to. But just leaving your computer lying around while you go to the bathroom at a conference? No, stick it in your bag, take it with you.
Oh, at a conference. Sure, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, basically within the realms of what's reasonable, if you have the choice of leaving it or not leaving it, don't leave it.
Yep.
You know, you're never going to get the risk to zero unless you take your computer, encase it in concrete, and throw it in the bottom of a river. Or actually, that is one of the proposed solutions, by the way. If you want to be protected from this attack, take some cement, put it into your USB port. Done.
All right. Great.
Okay, so that's Poison Tap. Great. Yeah. Also,
did we know anything about Microsoft or Apple doing something to change that?
There is no word that I have yet seen from either of them.
I'm sure you'll let us know if they do.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Just while you're fixing show notes, there's a star instead of an ampersand between the two links for that story.
Okay.
It should be Ars Technica and Naked Security, not Ars Technica multiplied by Naked Security.
Okay.
Twitter have expanded their mute service, which basically to help empower people against trolls. So this is just a good thing. Yeah. So it's now you can do more muting of more people who are annoying you, and hopefully you never have to, but you can if you need to.
Okay.
So that is good. Also on the good news column, WhatsApp have added end-to-end encryption to their video calling service.
Nice. Are they the only ones with end-to-end encryption on video calling?
I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
FaceTime? Because FaceTime does.
Does it?
FaceTime. Okay. Yeah. Think. Pretty sure. Skype used to until Microsoft bought them. Microsoft got rid of that, but that's a whole other story. Now, so there is a bug which has been making a lot of news, and it's called Get Root on Linux. Sounds pretty bad.
Yeah.
Don't set your hair on fire. So this bug, in order to work at all, requires that you have your system be encrypted and requires that the attacker have physical access to your system. And if they succeed in hacking your system, they don't actually get by the encryption, which you have to have in order to be vulnerable. What they get is the /boot partition, and that is all. So they don't get any of your data or any of your stuff. The only theoretical use this could be is as a stepping stone to getting a keylogger onto your machine, but if they have physical access, they can just shove one of them in your USB port anyway. So on the whole, okay, grand, it'd be nice when they patch this, but on the whole, this is not one to lose sleep over.
Are we going to end all of these stories eventually with, but then again, the Raspberry Pi Zero takes care of all of that? You know?
Well, look, physical access is always game over, right?
Right.
You cannot really protect your computer if someone has physical access to it. I mean, that's been the case for a very, very long time. So, yeah, that's why I say an exploit that requires physical access doesn't scare me nearly as much as an exploit that doesn't. They're the scary ones. There's also been a whole big brouhaha over the fact that Apple sync call logs between your devices in a secure and encrypted way. Basically, the reason that you have all the cool continuity features is because iCloud keeps your stuff in sync. If this is a surprise to you, I'm shocked. And if you think this is a scandal, I think you just want some clickbait on your website. The best coverage of this was over on iMore. They explained the who, the whys, and the whats, and the, you know, basically there's no there. So I have linked in the show notes to the iMore piece because that is by far the best coverage I've seen of this whole thing.
You know, what bothers me most about this article is that if they're actually doing this and doing all this encryption stuff to sync between our devices, how come my messages don't actually sync correctly between my devices?
Oh, don't get me started on iCloud. But the biggest thing missing from iCloud is a giant big button saying sync now for goodness sake, please.
Bart and I now start every episode of Security Bits with waiting for iCloud to decide to let him see his own notes.
Yeah, and there's no particular consistency to it. I have two Macs here, the one I record on and my iMac. And on my iMac, the show notes may be there for 5-10 minutes before they show up on the other machine. And they're right next to each other on the same network. It's just iCloud. And with Dropbox, you can go and say sync now and something moves. And maybe it's only just doing it to make me feel better. Maybe it's actually doing nothing. But just having something to push makes me feel better. So even if Apple do one that does nothing, just let me push a button.
It's like in, what is it, Google Drive, where if you're writing in a Google Doc and you hit Command-S or Control-S on a PC, it lets you because you're going to want to, but it doesn't do anything because it's always saving.
Exactly. So just, you know, let me feel like I have some sort of power over this instead of it being arbitrary and annoying.
Right.
Okay, now there is also a new lock screen bypass for iOS. It's not good news, but it's not nearly as bad a news as it could be because it doesn't actually fully get by the lock screen. So they can never get to your home screen. They can never run apps. The quote-unquote only thing they can do is access your photos, messages, and contacts. So obviously that's not good, but it's also a long way off as bad as a lot of the other lock screen bypasses have been.
So. Well, how odd. Just photos, messages, and contacts. I wonder why those three things.
Because it's a partial lock screen bypass.
Okay.
So they're managing, because you can do all of these kind of things in the lock screen, sort of. And they're actually using a bug in the accessibility features to trick the phone into letting you see more than it should. But you're never actually out of the lock screen. So you're basically using some bugs in... I said, I think it's VoiceOver is a feature where the bug is, and so VoiceOver accidentally gives you access to more stuff than it should because it isn't fully locked down. Now, the whole concept of letting you access stuff through the lock screen is inherently dangerous, and the more Apple do this, the more problems they're going to make for themselves, and I really wish they'd stop already. It's a terrible idea. You're just turning your security model into a colander, and inevitably you punch one too many holes. I know people love it, but...
Yeah.
With Touch ID, I think its time has passed. When every device has Touch ID, the lock screen should just do nothing until you put your finger at it. When everyone has Touch ID. So, you know,
here's the one reason I do like some of those features, though, and I have it set up so I still do have to unlock the phone. But let's say I get a message from you and I want to respond to it immediately. I want to be able to 3D touch on that message you sent me. But if I unlock the phone first, that message is gone. And I have to go do some
not anymore.
More damn swiping
to get to it. Not with iOS 10. Okay, you've tweaked your iOS 10 so it doesn't behave like Apple designed it to, haven't you? You've gone into the accessibility settings and got your old home screen behavior.
I don't know what you're talking about. Let me tell you what does happen, because I don't think you heard me. If I now 3D touch on that, then it'll say, okay, now use your thumb. So, and then it takes me into the message.
Okay, but I can use my thumb and then 3D touch your notifications. I do it all the time. My phone doesn't do anything in the lock screen. I have my lock screen locked down.
I'm confused. If you send a message come up.
Yeah, I hold my finger on the home button. Nothing goes away. Then I force touch and reply.
Oh, yeah, that's because I have to hit the button 3 darn times to get into the phone right. If I have it set up that way.
It works really well with Touch ID in a modern phone. That's how it's supposed to work. That is how Apple wants you to use it so many times.
Ugh, it's tedious. It's a lot of touching. There's already so much swiping and touching now.
Okay, I pick up my phone, I rest my finger, and it's unlocked. That's it.
Right, so nothing then is... haven't executed anything yet.
Right, but I'm now on that screen.
So now you wanted to play a podcast. You have to hit it again.
No.
Yeah, you do.
Well, but if I want to interact with the lock screen, which is the problem you're saying, I now have my unlocked lock screen. I haven't done anything. I've just rested my finger on the button.
Okay, so you've traded one thing for the other thing. So now by having access to lock screen, now you don't have access to your phone. So you have to hit it again.
Okay, but all I
need
to do is press
the
home button once to get into my phone.
Yeah, but you've done it twice.
No, I haven't. I've picked it up. The screen has come on. I've just rested my finger. I haven't touched anything yet.
Oh, okay. Rested doesn't count as pushed. Okay. If that's a technicality.
Well, no, certainly not. Okay, but hang on. On these modern phones with Touch ID 2, it really doesn't. On Touch ID 1, I will grant you, because it's like a wait. Whereas in Touch ID 2, it just happens. It's just instant. So, look, phone's unlocked.
Yeah, so I sit there looking at the phone trying to figure out why I can't see anything on the phone yet. That's what happens to me every time. And I'm like, and then finally I read it where it says, click the home button, moron. So maybe it's too fast and I don't know it well enough yet. So, I mean, maybe I didn't give it a long enough try that way, but I hated it. The first thing I did was change that. Maybe I'm being a Luddite.
I'd suggest changing it back on a device with Touch ID 2.
Okay. If I don't... get back to you. I'm going to put it on, and by Christmas I get to put it back the other way if I still hate it. How's that?
Oh, that seems very fair. I didn't think you'd give me anywhere near that long a time. Yeah, no, that's very fair. But yeah, anyway, so that is to me the way it should go. When we all have fast Touch ID sensors, just don't do anything until we've touched your finger. And the other thing, of course, is the Apple Watch, because it uses the sensor to know when it's come off your arm, it can be safely unlocked on your wrist. And so a lot of my interactions are through the watch now.
Okay. All right. I'm turning it off.
And of course, the great thing with the watch is you can never get gloves that will work on a Touch ID sensor, right? Because while you may have capacitive tips in the fingers of your gloves, you're never going to have your fingerprints on the tips of your gloves. Mm-hmm. And even if you could, you wouldn't want to, because anyone who steals your gloves can suddenly become you. So in wintertime, the iPhone or the Apple Watch becomes way more useful because I can swipe on it with my gloves. And I don't need to unlock it because it has the sensor to know that it's still on my wrist since I last authenticated myself.
Gloves.
Anyway.
Sorry. So which way do I want rest finger to open is what I want on? Is that the only thing? Maybe I did change it back to that. Yeah, because it's been yelling at me to read the screen lately. So maybe I did turn it back and that's why it's irritating me.
Okay, well, I guess maybe just, you know, watch it and build up the appropriate memory, because I have my lock screen set not to allow me to do anything until I unlock it, and it's working really well for me.
Okay.
Whereas the old behavior was terrible for me, because as soon as I unlocked my phone, I lost everything I wanted to do. Whereas this new behavior doesn't do that. So everything that's happened since I last unlocked my phone is waiting for me, and then I can press through to go into the home screen should I need to.
Okay. Well, I've got to spend some time paying attention and see how much I hate it now.
Yeah. Okay, so coming back from that little tangent, Okay, so now we're back to those nice blue Android owners, but it's not just people who have a blue phone. It's lots of, there are at least 2 million affected Android users and counting. So, security researchers discovered a critical vulnerability that allows for the routing of millions of Android phones all over the world, and it all comes from a firmware that a whole bunch of Android phones from a whole bunch of different manufacturers use called Regentech. And this firmware doesn't correctly validate its over-the-air software updates. So if you're doing over-the-air software updates, you should be using HTTPS and you should be doing digital signatures so that the phone can be sure that the update is actually from who it's supposed to be from, like Apple and Adobe and Microsoft and everyone who has any basic undergraduate level understanding of security would do. But this company doesn't correctly validate the updates. It will just believe anything it's told. It will do those updates over HTTP instead of HTTPS. And what's worse, the phones will proactively reach out to a number of update servers. And they programmed in three domains into the firmware, but they only actually bought one of the three. And the other two, they just left unpurchased, sitting there waiting for someone to buy them. Now, lucky for planet Earth, the people who discovered this and the people who bought those unused domains were security researchers and not criminals.
Oh.
So the security company, what is their name in the show notes here? Because I do kind of want to give them credit for being so clever and smart. They bought the domains and BitSight. So BitSight bought the domains and have now been using those domains to passively watch who checks in and try to figure out exactly which makes and models of phone have this dodgy firmware.
Oh.
So they're effectively using them as a sinkhole. And so far, they've already identified at least 2 million different unique hits from different pieces of physical hardware. And of the hits they have picked up, the plurality are from the manufacturer Blue, who we talked about earlier. But the plurality is only a quarter. There are actually 47% of the devices they haven't been able to figure out who made them because there isn't enough unique in them that they've been able to figure out yet. So basically, we're expecting them to find out more. Ooh. But any of these devices are doing insecure over-the-air software updates, which means if you're in a Starbucks or whatever, someone could easily inject any old malware they wanted into your phone because it's not going to check. It's just going to believe everything it's told. So again, buy cheap phone, get really big problem. Now, it
so
does seem
do we
to me
know,
that this,
even though they're the plurality, and that is a cheap manufacturer, do we know that the other 47% are cheap phones? We don't really
know. But the other 47% we can't know, right? But of the other, so if you look at the pie chart in the Ars Technica story, you will see that Blue gets the big red slice, and then Infinix, Doogie, Liagu, Zulu, right? These are all cheap Chinese manufacturers.
Oh, I thought they said they didn't know who they were. No. It's 40%, then, 7% they don't know who they are. Another 25% they know who they are, but they're these companies we've never heard of.
Right. So basically a quarter is Blue, another approximately quarter is small Chinese manufacturers, and then you have this 47% that we haven't yet, at time of writing, figured out.
So this is probably really terrible for people in less developed countries where they rely on these really inexpensive phones.
It is. I guess the moral of the story would be you're better off buying a refurbished high-end phone. So you're better off buying, say, a secondhand iPhone 5S or something than you are buying a new cheap phone.
Hmm.
Just so long as you're still getting iOS updates or Android updates if you go an Android route. I guess that's sort of the cutoff, right? Don't go so low you can't get the latest OS. But I would definitely say you're better off buying secondhand and, you know, reinstalling the OS from scratch yourself so that there's nothing pre-installed to catch you out than buying these cheap phones. Because these cheap phones are all based off advertisement deals of some sort. They have to monetize. They're not charities. And they're monetizing by somehow getting at your privacy or, in this case, just by having really bad software on them. I mean, this isn't even that they're trying to be malicious. They're just, this is just really badly written firmware. I'm guessing it was cheap.
And there's no way to go the other way around and say ask manufacturers whether they used Regentech or they're not volunteering that information?
Well, I don't know. How could you? I mean, you could ask big name brands like Samsung, and I imagine the answer would be a very straightforward no. But after that, you're into lots of these little cheapo brands. I mean, is there even a list of everyone in China who makes cheap Android phones?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, the ecosystem is sick. And I can't really find a way to spin this into a happy story because it just isn't.
I guess it's a happy story if you're an Android user who uses a real, you know, big name manufacturer.
Right. Yeah. So Android isn't a thing. It's a spectrum, right? And at the very, 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 very top in terms of security are Android devices that get their software updates directly from Google with no middle people. In those cases, you're doing pretty well security wise. And the other end of the spectrum, you have these devices that get abandoned straight away. And there's all sorts of stuff in between. So, you know, a Pixel versus a Blue phone. Yeah, they both run Android. No, they're not the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I had my my son's girlfriend asking me last night for her brother what kind of iPad he should get. And I said, oh, he should get an iPad Pro. And his answer back was, how about a Fire tablet? And the Fire tablet, as of right now, is $33. And I said, it's probably worth that. You know, I mean, it might be worth even more than that. That's probably not a complete and utter waste of money, but it's not an iPad.
Whatever you think you're not getting the same as if you spend 10 times that.
Yeah, one could guess.
I've seen some of these cheap tablets. Oh, my God. Anyway, the next story ends happily, but initially I thought it was going to be a bad news story. So initial reporting was that Home Depot and Office Max, who are owned by the same company, were caught with their pants down to some extent. They were running a malware scanner from disgracedcompanysupport.com, who you may or may not remember us talking about before, because they agreed to pay $8.5 million to settle a lawsuit because their scanner was just telling people porky pies. It was telling people they had malware infections they should pay to have removed that simply were never present.
Oh,
so what a great company to use to scan. So Home Depot and Office Max were running these scans on people's devices. These scans were returning fictitious problems, which they were then charging people quite a lot of money to fix. Now, Home Depot are like, oh, we had no idea this was a scam, and we've stopped using it now. I'm not sure I believe them, but that's a personal opinion, and I certainly can't prove that. So either way, the good news is...
Well, now that they've been caught, they probably aren't.
Right, well, yeah, they've now said, oh, sorry, no, this goes completely against our policies. Oh, this is absolutely terrible. We will stop using this product immediately. Okay, good. That's a good outcome.
By the way, I just got a promotional email from Office Depot while you were speaking that sentence.
Ah, love it. And again, we have... local newspapers to thank for this reporting.
Really?
Local papers, basically. Yeah, local papers went in with a machine. They had a security researcher check the whole thing out. They were out of the box, brand new machines. They passed all checks. There was nothing wrong with them. They went into Home Depot, who immediately told them they were riddled with ransomware.
Office Depot.
Office Depot.
I make that mistake.
Slightly different.
Yeah.
Slightly different.
And Office
they
Depot
wandered
told
into these brand new machines, and Office Depot said, no, riddled with malware. Please pay us $120, I think it was.
Oh, they better be giving some money back. That's what they really better be doing. Wow.
So as I say, good old-fashioned gumshoe reporting.
Yeah, they must have had a hint that something was happening.
Someone obviously tipped someone off to say, I think there's something afoot in the wind here.
Wow.
As the mixed metaphor goes. And actually, that's a joke for anyone who remembers the BBC TV show Blackadder. One of the characters, Baldrick. Yeah, well, Baldrick is an idiot, so Baldrick will say things like, there's something afoot in the wind.
Anyway. I worked for a guy who would do those kind of sentences, and my favorite was, I can smell the blood at the end of the tunnel. He also said, pom-pom and circumstance. He was fun.
Oh, I do love that. There's some interesting images in my head now. Anyway. Firefox have released an iOS app, which is basically a browser with ad blockers built in, but they're not advertising it as a browser with ad blockers. They're advertising it as a really quick browser, because obviously all these ad trackers and stuff slow things down.
Huh.
So technically it's a privacy win, but I guess to avoid lawsuits, they're calling it an efficiency win. But either way, it's an interesting idea. So that may be worth checking out.
I don't know whether you said it. I see it in the show notes. I didn't hear you say this is an iOS browser.
I think I said that, but okay, if I didn't, I'll just stress that it is iOS. Yeah.
Wow.
It is
an iOS app. That's kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. It's nice to have a bit of choice.
Yeah.
And second to finally, so penultimately, I guess, Google have issued warnings to journalists and academics, including Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman, to warn them that nation states have attacked their accounts, or rather have attacked their accounts. Now, Google are saying, for security reasons and for basically making their scanners effective, there's a time delay on the notification unless the attack succeeds. So if the attack fails, they wait an arbitrary amount of time and then tell you that you have been attacked at some time in the past. And the reason is they don't want to tip their hand. They don't want to allow the attackers to figure out how Google are figuring out what's going on. So the chances are this dates to the election. But we don't know that, and Google won't say.
You know that President Obama won a Nobel Prize.
I do know that.
So that would be interesting.
Yes. Well, but in this case, it's basically Paul Krugman who would be left academic, I guess. You know, basically, New York Times op-ed columnist was certainly not a fan of the president-elect. I think that's a fair summation of Mr. Krugman's opinions. Sorry, Professor Krugman's opinions.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's just an interesting point. And so this is not to say the attacks are happening now, and Google are explicit about that. They say that because they want to protect their algorithms, they're only telling you that it happened in the past. Okay. But again, it's something to take note of, that this is going on. There are nation states attacking people, and it seems almost certain it's related to the U.S. elections.
Let me back you up one. On the Firefox browser, it's called Firefox Focus, and I don't know why the article says that they're pushing it as a speed browser. The name says Firefox Focus, the privacy browser.
Oh, okay.
And when I searched for Firefox in the App Store, it only came up as an ad. The first thing that comes up is the regular Firefox. Actually, I shouldn't say only. The first thing you see is Firefox, but above that was an ad for Firefox Focus by Mozilla. So I'm going to save Mozilla a little bit of money and go, because that's not how I found out about it. But if you see it as an ad, that is the real one that he's talking about.
Okay, good. Because it's on my list of things I want to do this weekend. Because I think it's good to have a little bit of choice on iOS.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, so then New York Times again. New York Times are reporting, and this is their report, so it's uncorroborated, that Facebook have tasked a chunk of their engineers with creating a censorship engine for China so that the Chinese can decide which stories should and should not appear on users' feeds without having to bother Facebook's little head about the specifics. Basically, give them the tool and let them go censor away to their heart's content. The New York Times based their reporting on sources who they say are former and current software engineers.
Interesting.
I mean, we can't say any more than that, right? Because it's based on he said, she said to some extent. But I thought it was definitely worth pointing people to. But I can't say any more than that, really, can we?
Well, this is kind of, it's Mike Isaac, and he's not an idiot. Funny as heck to follow on Twitter, by the way. I mean, definitely follow him just for the comedy. It says in here, he states that some Facebook employees left the company to protest this censorship project.
Which I certainly would if I were a software engineer and asked to do something like that, I'd sod off. Yeah. Which I guess also explains why it would come, if it's true, it explains why it's a story, because if people are leaving in protest, well, they're probably also talking to the press.
Yeah.
As I say, it is what it is. Notable breaches. We have, oddly enough, a good news story in the notable breaches section. Oh, I think there's a one missing. I think Adobe will pay $11 million to settle a lawsuit filed against them by 15 state attorneys general. Notice the correct pluralization from the silly foreigner. So 15 U.S. states attorneys general regarding their epic 2013 data breach.
Well, good. Hey, so... do you say MacBooks Pro and iPhones 7?
Unlike attorneys general, there is no centuries-long history of how you're supposed to do that.
Yeah. Well, the reason I started saying iPhones 7 is because if you think about the iPhone 6 and 6S, how do you say the plural of iPhone 6?
Without making it sound like it's another model completely.
Right. So if you say iPhones 6. And if you say it fast enough, nobody notices you're saying it correctly.
I think I know Ken does it a lot as well. It might go as Ken. He pluralizes the first.
Yeah, it's kind of tempting.
Kind of tempting. I like it as a pronunciation, just because you have this, you know, surgeons general, attorneys general. I mean, that's pretty good, you know, things to be riffing off. That sounds pretty good anyway.
Yeah.
Hello, the up and coming or struggling, I'm not quite sure which, social media have been caught in a snafu, which thankfully isn't as bad as it sounds. So I think you'll see headlines like "Elo caught in plain text password kerfuffle" or stuff like that. Yeah, it is plain text passwords, but it's not as bad as you think. So due to a bug in their software, they were accidentally encoding usernames and plain text passwords into their URLs. Now, they're all delivered over HTTPS, which means that people who are not on either end don't see those URLs. The only real danger here would be that the URLs are saved in a log somewhere, which could only happen on your computer, on your corporate firewall/proxy server, if you are in such an environment, or on their end. So the exposure is minimal. But having said that, why not just change your password?
I wonder how long Elo is going to be around. My entire sense of when that was announced was, well, that'll be gone in 10 minutes, because I'm getting so weary of Google throwing stuff. It used to be they threw stuff against the wall and 90% would stick and you could get to play with it forever. And now it's like, it seems like 10% sticks.
Okay, this isn't Elo, this is Elo.
Oh, totally different. What?
So Elo is the social media you invited me to, actually, which I proceeded to never use.
It is? I thought you said
E-L-O.
Google. Okay.
No,
well, no,
I said Elo.
It's E-L-L-O.
Is there two L's?
Well, yeah, you put it with one, and I checked the Naked Security article, and they had two. And Elo is not, that's not Google? Well, maybe it isn't.
No, Elo is Google.
I don't know what we're talking about then.
It's a social network with the black and white look and the smiley face.
I was in it. That rings no bells at all.
Well, they still send me spam because I accepted the invitation you sent me.
Wow. I mean, I'm not disbelieving you at all.
There's so much, right?
I'm going to go back over to 1Password and see if I have an Elo account. I do. Look at that. Huh? Wonder what it was. Okay.
Highly successful, obviously, in the Sheridan household.
All right. Well, okay. It's E-L-L-O, and who knows what that even is anymore. Okay.
There you go. So you might just check if that's a password, if you reused anywhere else. If it is, change it everywhere and don't reuse it again. Not that I think you'd do such a thing. Just saying. Finally, then, in the notable breaches, unfortunately, the U.S. Navy has warned 130,000 of their sailors that their personal information, including their social security numbers, have been leaked through a hacked or through a compromised laptop. And what they mean by compromised, we do not know. They are being vague, probably for good reason.
Why? How do we know whether it was encrypted or anything?
We don't. We don't. All we know is that a compromised laptop has been implicated in the loss of 130,000 sailors' data. The sailors involved are being contacted at the moment by the Navy to say that, yes, this affects you. So that's literally all we know, is that it was a laptop. It appears to have been, the incident appears to have been caught by automated monitoring done by a service provided by HP. So the reason they know they were hacked is because HP's monitoring software saw that the laptop was hacked, but other than that, we're getting no details, which is, again, probably reasonable for the Navy not to tell us exactly how.
Yeah,
at least not
so.
To change a few things.
But then again, all those people would have had their records compromised by that giant breach that affected everybody who worked for the government.
Oh,
the OPM.
P? OPM.
Yeah, OPM. No. Yeah. So there, you know, all those people's data was out there anyway.
For some reason, I keep thinking Heaven is a Half Pipe, and I'm sure that was the name of the band with that terrible one-hit wonder. Anyway, I have a bunch of stuff and suggested reading. Most of it I'm going to leave to people themselves because it's bad news, but I do want to draw your attention to a few things. So the first is technically off topic, but I think relevant to this audience all the same. So I have, and you have, been very happy with Apple's line of routers. And we have also regularly noted that as security problems come up, they strangely never seem to affect Apple's routers. Unfortunately, Apple have reportedly stopped making them and disbanded, or rather have disbanded the team that looks after them. So we are assuming those are now abandonware, that Apple have given up on them. Now, there's no sign of any vulnerabilities and there's no indication we won't get security updates if such a thing is found. But going forward, this appears to be a dead product line. So that means we now have to think about other routers next time our router breaks and we need to buy a new one. And conveniently, Dave Hamilton just wrote a really good article over on the Mac Observer outlining sort of what I would consider to be the three leading candidates.
Three leading candidates very specifically for mesh networking, not three leading candidates.
Which I think
candidates.
Is the way to go.
But that isn't what he's saying necessarily.
Okay, fair. Yeah, okay, sorry. I wouldn't consider anything but a mesh these days.
Really?
So I'm showing my own prejudices here.
Hmm. Yeah, I just put in one router and I can do everything everywhere. So,
whatever way Irish houses are made, they don't work like that. So I'm fed up of having black spots. I want a mesh.
Hmm. Okay.
But anyway, so he goes through the leading mesh providers and comes to the conclusion I was hoping he would, that the Eero ones that seem to be the ones marginally in the lead at the moment, but keep an eye on Netgear. It's basically the
Netgear as the Orbi. I love this article and I tweeted it, Facebook, I don't think I LinkedIn it, Google Plused it, put it out everywhere because it's a tremendous article. It's 5 pages long. I read every bit of it. Fantastic description. He waits until the 5th page to tell you that Eero is an advertiser. Now they're I trust Dave more to tell me the truth than I trust me to tell you the truth when I advertise. I do. Because I was working with him on something where one of the vendors that he advertised for did something that wasn't quite right. And he talked about it on his show while they were actively advertising. So I do trust
that's
Dave.
That's a good test.
But you should know that Eero was one of his advertisers and is right now actively. The other thing is that in the article, he explained something interesting is that the Orbi, which is the Netgear offering, isn't technically a mesh because both of the satellites talk to the original base station. They don't talk to each other. So the Eero might be a little more meshy. And that's kind of interesting too. So I think that might be better, but I'm in love with my Netgear router. So I'd probably, if I had to tilt the needle, I might tilt towards the Orbi.
Yeah. The thing is you don't have a problem with reception around the house. So great. If you don't need a mesh, good for you.
Yeah. I might've done it though, had I just read this article before I'd gotten that, but, plus mine's wicked looking. Actually, there was a discussion in, I think it was in one of the Google Plus groups. Guy said, I really want to get like the Nighthawk X8 because it's really wicked, but my wife would never let me put that in the living room. And because of the configuration of his house, it has to be. So he was going to go Eero and he was confused about what he should do next. So the nice thing is the Orbi and the Eero are pretty if you have a significant other who likes things to look pretty instead of badass. Sorry, excuse my French. You know,
I can see the advantages both ways. Like, I quite like the idea of a sort of a snazzy, fancy pants looking, you know,
wicked,
interesting router. And I quite like the idea of something that just blends into the furniture. I can see both as being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But whichever you need, there's offerings for both. So.
Well, there we go. And then the last thing I just want to sort of draw your attention to and suggested reading is a little project from a Dutch media company called VPRO. Which is a dumb website that sort of illustrates to you exactly how much a website can watch you if it wants to with JavaScript enabled. So if you click into the Naked Security article, there'll be a link to the actual page. It talks at you and stuff, so I'm not sure you want to do it on the air. But basically, it will show you everything you do on the page. Like, oh, you moved your mouse left, you moved your mouse right, you've hovered on the button. Oh, you finally clicked the button, and it will just talk to you. And then when you go to leave, it will freak you out the most because, of course, there are JavaScript event handlers to deal with what to do when someone tries to unload the page.
Oh, geez. We should write that.
And it will keep talking to you longer than you expect.
Oh, that's creepy. Which one? I see all these links, and I'm not seeing which one it was. What's it called?
Click, click, click.
Oh, okay. Click, 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 huh?
So as I say, it's in a funny Dutch accent as well, which is just makes things better, I guess.
Cool.
And all the rest of the stuff, I think, pretty much, apart from the very last story, is all bad news. And the last story isn't, it's interesting, but it's not worth digging into.
Okay.
Oh, and I have a palate cleanser.
Oh, because... good.
So Backblaze have as a guest blog post by I forget his name now. He's done lots of podcasting and stuff. Why is the byline gone just when I want it?
Someone we know, one of our little friends.
Peter Cohen.
Okay.
So it's a guest post by Peter Cohen over on Backblaze's blog, A History of Hard Drives. Ooh. Starting off with the RAMAC from IBM, which was 5 megabytes and the size of a room, which you rented from IBM. So at the rates that they were charging in 1956, your iPhone 7 would cost you $20.5 million a month.
Nice. I like it.
So there you go. So it's an interesting article. It goes through sort of the history of hard drives. Lots of cool pictures. One of the things you'll notice is they shrink quite a bit over time.
So it's fun to read through, huh?
I think it's fun to read through. It counts as a palate cleanser. There's nothing scary about it.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. All right, Bart. I guess we won't see you next week.
No, I have Christmas is coming. I have lots of things I need to do that I've been putting off. So no, you won't see me next week.
Darn.
But I will see you bright and bubbly with lots of new fun stuff to talk about 2 weeks from now.
All right.
So until then, I'm going to get this right. Stay patched and stay secure.
Well, after this very lonely episode, at least for me, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. You can email me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with Podfeet. Can't remember what it is? It's probably got podfeet.com/something, podfeet.com/Patreon, podfeet.com/Facebook, podfeet.com/Google+, podfeet.com/Amazon. Don't forget that one. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, next week we will have a live show. Head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.